Everyone. Good evening. So, we'll start with some reflections from the prompt last week. If you weren't here last week, it's not a problem. Don't worry about it. Just every week, we're sort of closing with a prompt for people to reflect on throughout the week. So, this is the one from last week. We looked at Dogen and Kazan, two of our ancestors who we were celebrating in a ceremony on Sunday. And the prompt was a quote from Genjo Koan, one of Dogen's fascicles in the Shobo Genzo. And so I'm curious if anyone had any reflections on that or anything else that came up in class last week that you'd like to share. Or I'm curious if anyone ended up coming to the ceremony on Sunday and what your experience of that was like. Thomas.
Raise your hands
Yukio.
up. There you go.
What came to mind, this is Yukio, was something that feels a little bit abstract, but it feels like kind of an easier way to talk about some of the more more like a relationship or career. And it was a memory from when I was fairly little, and I asked my mom to come to the forest, and I wanted to show her the fairies, right? And so I have this really clear memory of like I'm lying on my belly, like, and that's what we were there for, and she's standing behind me, and then I have this like realization that she couldn't see them, and it was kind of devastating, actually, right? And I have no recollection whatsoever of what I saw, but then like it's kind of like the curtain dropped on being able to see the world in that way. And I think that, yeah, that kind of struck me with like there's like a lot of different ways to see. And as an adult, I've tried to sort of like imagine what that was like. And I think that I see a variation of that as an adult, but it's like it's not Disney, but like there's something that you can see in like being really present in a like a forest like that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a beautiful story.
So, two things for me. One, I thought of a cynical Russian joke that happiness is just over the horizon, but the horizon is an imaginary line that recedes into the distance as we approach it. And the other, I thought of times when I've been on the Atlantic and the Pacific, and but I've never lost sight of the shore. And I thought of that, both of those, as it relates to attachment, and it got my mind bouncing around on.
Thank you.
So I love these Dharmic riddles. What came to mind for me, I guess, initially was just trying to decipher kind of like what Dogen was possibly referring to. And so to me, it started kind of going towards the impermanence of what the ocean is, perhaps, and form and possibly connection, even maybe with Heart Sutra teachings related to form and emptiness. And then relating it to the human form, I started thinking, you know, the ocean metaphor and water and how much of the human body is water. And, you know, part of the practice in Zazen is stilling the body and thus subsequently stilling the water. And perhaps metaphors, both literal and metaphorical, with stilling the water and reflection and insight in that sense. So, kind of interesting play between water and then more of the other Buddhist classical ideas.
Yeah, so I hear a lot of connections there.
Hi, this is Dial. When I read this section, it reminds me of my own, the limitations of my own perspective, especially like my own life, and that, that can have one of a couple different feeling tones. But it, like presently, the things in my life that I'm love the most or that I'm most excited about are like things and people that I didn't even consider existed before. And like that's so exciting that there's things over the horizon beyond my sight line. It makes me really want to set sail. And it's just, yeah, I guess this passage takes that like concept and makes it not scary. It makes it exciting because I like sailing pirates.
Hi, this is Ed. Well, of course, this reminded me of Moby Dick. If you've ever actually read Moby Dick, Melville goes on and on and on and on about the ocean. And most people skip over that part. And I didn't because I have a completion fixation. And Jung talked about that and saw Melville's descriptions of the ocean as descriptions of the unconscious mind and the interconnectedness of everything. And so this made me think of that as being very similar, very related.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention last week in the discussion, it was about lineage and how I think the prompt was to think of who had influenced us to come to the place where we had been. And just the four of us in our circle mentioned not bloodlines, but animal companions, chosen family, rock music, and teachers. And that even concepts themselves, as we think of them, all have a different perspective from everyone's individual reality. And that whatever perspective we have of all things being circular, we can't ever fully perceive them from each other person's perspective, except in dialogue and relationship.
Nice. Any last comments? One more, Landon?
Hi, Landon. I didn't get a chance to read this until now because I wasn't here last week. But I like after reading it and the questions through like 8 times, I was just thinking about how recently I've had this like kind of stuckness on focusing on specific characteristics of my internal ocean. Either I'll be in a really upset mood and all I see is the sharp and the aggressive parts of the ocean, or I'll try to suppress that bad mood and try to be in a good mood, and all I'll see is the like soft, happy parts of the ocean. And that also doesn't feel right. And it is so vast and all these characteristics. And I think that trying to filter for only the characteristics that I want in that moment or that I'm spiraling into doesn't feel full or whole. And that unless we have that whole view, I don't know, it's a simplistic and dishonest version of our life. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for your comments and reflections. Great. I think it's Colleen's turn.
How are we going to do the slides? Are we going to show them as we go, or okay? Maybe so. So you'll okay. We'll figure it out.
All right.
right. So tonight, our topic for the evening is we're going to be looking at the three largest schools, sects of Buddhism that are the most prominent sects of Buddhism very broadly. So that's Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. And so Reju and I will be sharing just little bits about each of them for a little bit of compare and contrast. And then you'll have an opportunity to reflect on how that feels for you. So I'm going to start with Theravada Buddhism. Theravada is the oldest. Oh, it's kind of hard to see. Okay. Oh, I think that might be better. Reju prepared some slides, and I haven't practiced exactly with the slides. So Theravada is the red section there, and then also Sri Lanka down at the bottom of India. It's the oldest surviving school of Buddhism, sometimes called the Way of the Elders. And so after Buddha's death, many sects arose. At one point, there were at least 18 different sects of Buddhism. And Theravada is the outgrowth of one of those. And like all of those other sects died out, but Theravada continued. And so, Reju's got some really lovely slides of some Theravada-related temples. So Theravada developed in southern India and Sri Lanka. And today, it's prominent, the official language, the official religion in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Cambodia, also very prominent in Thailand. So that you can see that on this, reflected on this map here. Theravada relies completely on the Pali Canon. And we haven't talked a lot about what the Pali Canon is yet, so I'm going to slip a little bit of that in here. It's called Pali because it was written down in a language that was called Pali. It's an ancient Indo-Aryan language in India. And it's the canon because it is like all of the collected works. These texts were gathered and written down about 450 years after the Buddha died. And so he spoke Prakrit, probably a version of Prakrit. So this was not the language that he spoke. This was another language. And so the way that these texts came to be written down, after the Buddha died, there was a council of some of his followers about 50 years after he died. Not 50 years after he died, some years after he died. And Ananda quoted everything that he had heard, because he had heard every lecture that the Buddha had ever given, and he had memorized them. So he quoted all of them. And so this was carried forth as an oral tradition. And then about 450 years later, it was finally written down on palm leaves. And this came to be known as the Pali Canon. Okay, just showing pictures. Practice emphasis in Theravada is emphasizing the teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, and a really strong emphasis on Vinaya, which is their kind of moral path that they follow, a lot of rules and pretty formal path that they follow with rules and the way that they have to behave within their community. The goal of Theravada is to become an arhat. It's more focused on one's individual enlightenment. And practices include in modern Theravada include insight meditation and calm abiding to develop wisdom and to achieve nirvana. And Theravadins believe that there was only ever one Buddha. So, in the Mahayana pantheon, we have many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Theravadins have just the one Shakyamuni Buddha. And they do have Bodhisattvas, but they're quite rare and considered beings destined for full enlightenment. So they don't have the broad pantheon of bodhisattvas that we have. Pretty conservative and literal belief in the Pali canon, and so not believing in like Mahayana sutras. So that is our overview of Theravada. That's it too, yeah. So Mahayana is sort of another one of three, and it's in the yellow mostly. So a lot of East Asia. And Mahayana means great wheel, great vehicle. And it appears to have developed in India about the first century Common Era. It spread through China to Japan, Korea, and also into some parts of Southeast Asia, especially Vietnam. And you can also see some parts of Indonesia and the Philippines. One mythology of how it spread was through our ancestor Bodhidharma, who is said to have brought it from India to China. And at the encouragement of his teacher, Prajnatara, who we read a little bit about last week through Keizan's Denkaroku. It differs from the Theravadin systems in that it has its own set of sutras, like Colleen just mentioned, many of which were supposedly spoken by the Buddha, so they also start with "Thus I have heard," and it's Ananda's voice. But then they're held in a safe place underwater by the Nagas, who are dragon people, so that they could be kept until people could actually like hear them, so they could be ready for the Mahayana sutras. And that accounts for the difference in time between when the Pali Canon happened and when the Mahayana sutras happened. They were being kept safe by the Nagas. Some of the prominent sutras of the Mahayana include the Lotus Sutra, the Prajnaparamita or Wisdom Sutras, which also includes the Heart Sutra, and the Avatamsaka Sutra, but there's a whole bunch. And we'll talk about sutras a little bit more in the Pali Canon a little bit more next week. But the Mahayana sutras are distinct in the ways in which they represent the Buddha and the focus of practice. As Colleen mentioned, the Theravadin practice focuses primarily on the Pali Canon, the original teachings of the Buddha that we discussed a few weeks ago, notably the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And there's a singular Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. But the Mahayana sutras have like a pantheon of Buddhas. It's not actually a theon, but a pan Buddha-on and a pan Bodhisattva-on. Because there's lots and lots of Buddhas and lots of Bodhisattvas, and they appear again and again and in all sorts of different worlds. And there's lots of talk of how many worlds as there are sands in the Ganges, and then times that by a million or something like that. So there's lots and lots of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the Mahayana sutras. Also, there's a story that in Theravada Buddhism, there's a focus on an arhat, becoming an arhat, which is to become enlightened, to achieve nirvana oneself. And the story continues that in Mahayana Buddhism, the ideal is to become a bodhisattva or to be a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is an enlightened being that vows to stay in the saha world, in the world of suffering, so as to help other beings until everyone does it all together. So that's the big difference, is this idea of bodhisattvas. Oh yeah, we can have some more pictures. That's okay. We didn't talk about those, but this is a Pure Land temple. There's the video. This is cool. We'll come back. We'll just watch right now. So
good on time.
One of the Mahayana schools. There's a whole bunch. Is called Pure Land Buddhism. So here's just this short little video from a temple in Pure Land Buddhism. And their Buddha is called Amitabha. Lots of other Buddhas are recognized, but the Buddha that they sort of focus on is Amitabha Buddha or Amida Buddha.
So these are all the Buddhas. That's good. Yeah, so some of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are familiar. Like I said, in Pure Land, Amitabha or Amida Buddha is sort of the primary Buddha. We've got some of these other Bodhisattvas here in the hall. We have Manjushri, who is the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. And you can't see her right now, but over there is Kanzeyan, Bodhisattva of Compassion. Over here, we have Fudo, who is sort of an interesting character. But another Buddha, Bodhisattva, who's often in Zen halls, is Samantabhadra. And they show up in all sorts of different sutras, and they are sort of like embodiments of particular traits. So like I said, Manjushri is sort of an embodiment of wisdom, or archetype of wisdom. And the same for Kanzeyan with compassion. And for Samantabhadra, it's skillful activity. And another one is Kushitagarbha or Jizo Buddha, who is sort of an embodiment of vow. So these different bodhisattvas sort of take on different roles and can be embodied in different forms. And they show up in different ways and have different sort of relationships and interactions with each other and with different disciples and with different Buddhas in all sorts of ways. Often at the beginning of Mahayana sutras, the way it starts out is listing everyone who's there. And they're like all these bodhisattvas and Buddhas from different lands with all these fantastic names. As I mentioned, when we started looking at this one, there's lots of different subfields of Mahayana. Oops, went too far. So Pure Land is one. Also, there's a type of Pure Land called Jodo Shinshu, which is the most most practiced kind of Buddhism in Japan. It's also practiced widely in the United States. There's another temple in Japan that's a Pure Land temple. Zen, both Rinzai and Soto, is Mahayana. And Nichiren, which is a particular practice that really focuses on the Lotus Sutra, is also Mahayana. And there's also a particular subtype of Mahayana that's often seen as its own, sort of depends who you talk to, which is Tibetan Buddhism. And I'm going to turn it back over to Coeen to talk about that and other Vajrayana practices.
Yeah, so Vajrayana and Tibetan Buddhism. Oh, we're going to watch it again. So the blue areas is a lot of it, and the purple. Yeah, so the blue and the purple areas. Yeah, it is within that blue area, the southern blue area. Here I can, yeah, the purple is an edge of India, and then the purple is Nepal, and then you said where's Tibet is in the blue area. Yeah. Okay, Vajrayana, also sometimes called the diamond vehicle, originated in North India around the 5th to 7th century Common Era. It's considered, as Reju said, kind of a subset of Mahayana, but quite specialized. Vajrayana emerged from Tantrism, which is esoteric practices, which arose from esoteric practices in Hinduism. So it's sort of, you know, at a point where esoteric Hinduism met Buddhism, and then they decided to have esoteric Buddhism as well. We saw on the map, mostly in the Himalayan regions like Tibet, Nepal, and Mongolia. So Vajrayana incorporates esoteric texts called tantras and also uses Mahayana sutras. There is ritual instruction for lamas. They have texts that have ritual instructions for lamas. There are esoteric transmissions, which are teachings given from the guru to the student. These are also known as initiations. They have meditations on mandalas, and they use subtle energy bodies, which can be potentially dangerous without proper guidance. they also use a lot of complex visualizations, tantric practices and mudras, visualization of deities. And there's a lot of symbolism of the vajra, and this is an image of a vajra, which is a ritual implement representing indestructibility and irresistible force, embodying the union of wisdom and compassion. So Vajrayana is just full of rich visual imagery. I just always think of it as very colorful, like, and lots of prayer flags and prayer wheels and that kind of thing. The goal or ideal of achievement in Vajrayana is to achieve Buddhahood in one lifetime through rapid transformation. So this idea of like getting to enlightenment, to nirvana as fast as possible. So that is kind of their point is getting there as quickly as you can through all of these elaborate means and visualizations and things. And now, oh yeah, you have a little more you're going to talk about. Yes.
So these can look pretty different, which is partially why I pulled up the pictures, and they can sound pretty different. And they developed in different cultures and informed different cultures, which in turn informed them. So it's easy to think that they're really different. And in a lot of ways, that's true. And one of the things that all of them hold is this sort of idea of an absolute and a relative. So there's a relative truth in that each one of us is all different. Like, we've got like 35 people in here that have different goals and ideas and bodies and thoughts and et cetera, et cetera. And also, we have a lot of shared in common, and we aren't at all separate from each other. And so I think that that is also true of these practices. And I think it's in part why these practices developed. I had the opportunity to spend some time away in the spring. I practiced at two other temples, which were both mostly Soto Zen. So they weren't really that different, but there was a lot that was different about them. And one of the things that was really rich to me was seeing those differences and noticing how really beautiful and wholesome it was that there's such different practices for such different beings. So I'm expanding that little experience I had to this. Like, there's so many different Buddhisms for so many different people, so that if anyone wants to, they can find a way in. And I'm thinking of that as sort of like such a wide open door. Like, there's lots of different ways in. And like, maybe you're here now in a Soto Zen temple and you're listening to us talk, a Soto Zen teacher and a Soto Zen priest. And that's great. Welcome. Please feel comfortable here. But also, if some of this stuff looks like, I like all those colors, that looks a lot more exciting. Or, oh, those guys are sitting outside and that seems cool. Like, go try it out. Like, find your way in, because that's the thing that is important and special, is that there's so many different practices for so many different people. And I'm just enthralled by it. You have something to add, Ed? Yeah. I don't know. Let's look. That says both Eastern and Northern Buddhism. So kind of a both blue and yellow are practiced there, which makes sense because that's what green is. I think that's my little speech.
All right.
Yeah.
So now I'll take that and then distributing
things. Yeah.
So now we're going to go into our activity. So given what you understand about these three main types of Buddhism, we're offering you an opportunity to create a mandala to demonstrate your expression of that. We don't have pictures of mandalas.
Oh, we do? Sorry. There we go.
So here are some images of mandalas. Mandalas are typically circular art form, but you can make yours any shape that you want. Primarily, but not only seen in Vajrayana Buddhism, certainly not only seen in Vajrayana Buddhism. We make them here sometimes. We make them at Dharma Camp. We make a pretty big deal about it at Dharma Camp, actually. They can be used as an object of meditation and or to venerate a particular deity or bodhisattva, and they are sometimes made of sand to depict the ever-changing and impermanent nature of reality. And they also, I think, are a lovely reflection of the theme of our classes, which is our relationships and community. So within a mandala is a whole series of relationships and community and sangha. So now is your chance to draw a mandala, considering what you've learned about these three different types of Buddhism. All right, so you have some times, at least 10 minutes to work on that.
Absolutely. Who would like to start?
This is Christian. I can talk about just the one I drew. I was trying to think of something that felt more reverent, but this idea just popped in my head. I couldn't think of anything else, but I drew like a little hand doing a karate chop, because I don't know how familiar everyone is with anime, but there's this trope of a character who, like, if there's a big group of people with all these crazy magical abilities and all these powers, there's always one character and they're like, I have no special abilities, but I'm really good at like fighting physically. And I guess that's kind of what like Zen feels like to me. It's just like we there's all this stuff other people do, but we just sit. So that's what popped into my head. Anyway, who's next?
This is Andy. I think I don't know about other people, but I wanted to draw something where there was three separate things, but as I drew that, I had this tendency to want to bleed them together to kind of have them connected and sort of one sort of represented or growing out or influencing the other. And so that was an interesting, an unplanned thing. I was very, here's this section and this section and this, but the interrelatedness sort of came out.
It's an amalgamation of things. I'm just gonna say I really like this like blue and purple little pulse. Yeah, that's so cool. That's the first one I saw and I was like, that's amazing. Yes.
I'm Nick. I like this one that looks like a bean or something. Yeah.
Mine ended up distressingly representational.
Mine ended up being fairly formless. Because when I thought about all the traditions, it's really the essence that ties them together. So I found myself thinking about the circle, the brushstroke, the bell, the ball, the small pieces that we carry in common in the different traditions.
Donald, I'm really enjoying how, aside from the fact that everybody kind of, most everybody did a circle, they're all so different. Like everybody did a completely different thing. It's just neat to see how everybody's mind went. No.
Like Donald, I'm appreciating seeing all of them together. And it's just what I hoped for. And coming up with this activity with Coen was that we would be able to see like individual aspects come through, but also like a collective experience. So yay.
Yeah, agreed. I appreciate seeing like some familiar symbols like lotus flowers and trees, and then I also just, and Buddhas of course, and I also just appreciate some of the just abstract and lots of circles and wholeness.
Yeah, I love them all. They're all very beautiful. Lots of cool organic shapes, abstract stuff. I went with kind of a triangle motif representing a lot of the trinities in Buddhism, like Buddha Dharma Sangha, Vajrayana, Mahayana, Theravadin, and a lot of others, stillness, silence, spaciousness. There's a lot of trinities in all the different Buddhist traditions. So I felt like that was cool. I was trying to go for like a triangular fractal thing, but I ran out of time.
Is yours the one with the smiley face in it? Or no? Okay. Well, I'm charmed by them all. Especially the little smiley face on the triangle. And I'm really liking how in the pictures you showed some of the aesthetics and how that like is, to me, is translating into the feelings, or like, yeah, I tried to pick more like the feeling of those different traditions, even though I don't know much about them. But they have like some quality that I think is coming across here.
I'm Dio. I wanted mine to be as spacious and pointed as possible. And I started with the one dot, and like when I did that with the crayon, it was just such an experience. I was like, wow, that really was everything. And then I was looking at the dot, and it was just like this, so much going on with that dot. And I kept being tempted to add things like a boundary or something, and like I could not. And I'm very moved by, well, they're all so beautiful. I really love this happy one, dancing on the lotus. And when this one with the hearts and the brain came out, I like audibly was like, ah, that's so good. Yeah.
Thank you. We have to wrap it up now. Thank you so much. Well, thank you all for sharing. This is really wonderful. I don't know. We could leave these here for Vespers, I think. You can pick them up on your way out. So here's our prompt for the coming week. And these could get passed out at the same time, maybe. Sorry. Could pass those that way. So this is a quote from the Dalai Lama. The Buddha taught the four ways to bring together the disciples, and this was to ensure the welfare of others. The six perfections are practiced to achieve one's own good, and the four ways of bringing together the disciples to achieve the good of others. This involves, first of all, giving material gifts, then practicing right speech, then providing help, and finally harmonizing one's words and acts. Above all, it is important to keep this last point in mind. If we do not master our own mind, it is impossible to master the minds of others. We do not know whether it is possible to master the mind of another, but it is what we are supposed to do. Whatever the case, it is essential for those who claim that they wish to help others that they control their own minds. So your prompt for this week is to consider this quote and think about how it lands for you. How do you see yourself as a disciple of the Buddha in this paradigm that the Dalai Lama described? The Dalai Lama being the main leader of Tibetan Buddhism, but also Vajrayana Buddhism. And now we're going to move to Vespers.